Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punatu, Sahadiryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Can you please talk about the difference between kashayam and our inner traumas that we work on? You mentioned that kashayam takes a few months before they are over. Okay. And the other stuff can take much longer. Can you give some examples? Thank you. Well, you know, the word kashaya is a word that's actually just kind of in the tradition and used also in the Mandukya Upanishad in the Karika, where Gaudapada is actually listing the four obstructions to meditation. One has to do with vikshepa, agitations in the mind. One has to do with falling asleep. One has to... what to do with each one of these things. And one has to do with enjoying the ananda of the self. And the fourth one is the kashayas. So what they mean... So this is a kind of a technical term that's used as something that actually takes place in meditation. And so it's talked about as though thoughts and emotions and images and things are bubbling up from underneath, like from underwater and bubbling up to the surface, and they don't really have anything to do with the present. And so those are, when you're often sitting in meditation or if your mind is quiet, especially initially, that can happen, like a lot of, we'd say, things coming up from the unconscious, that the body relaxes and the mind relaxes, and kind of, instead of being like a very strong defense system, it kind of becomes more porous. You know, and so we talk about lots of thoughts kind of rushing up to the surface often. And that goes on for some time, not a long time. So the idea, and what they say in the Shastra, what Gaudapada said, is you just welcome them in the sense, just let them come, don't touch them, don't do anything with them, just allow them to come and to go without really having any type of reaction, just accepting them and letting them go their way. So that's how those were always dealt with, and that is something that points to the existence of an unconscious, though they don't use that word. Just like vasanas also, you know, Swamiji will translate vasanas as subtle likes and dislikes, with an example such as if somebody raises their eyebrow, you can project onto that something that's been resting inside that is triggered by that person's raising of the eyebrow. So some sort of subtle, some vasana is triggered by that, something that's existing inside in an unmanifest condition, which is kind of like how we would use the word unconscious. So that's technically the meaning of kashaya, is very simply that what I said, and then we can load a lot of other stuff on it in terms of bringing in the unconscious, bringing in inner child work, bringing in complexes, because for us in the kind of this modern era, we do have a lot of unconscious material that we have to work with, just because the culture, because the cow of Dharma is on one leg, and so things aren't, we don't have the confidence or the trust that our structures, our religious structures, or even our family structures, our community structures are lasting or valid or can be depended upon. And so a lot of things that are needed for me to be, for my psyche to just naturally project onto, so I don't have to think about it, those structures aren't there in any real way. So that's kind of a Jungian interpretation. So, technically, kshashayas are just those things that in meditation are coming up. You know, they're not things that are used traditionally, not things that I do inner dialogue with or anything like that. the understanding of traumas as kind of a Western understanding and very much acknowledged by Indian and Western teachers now. And how to be with those traumas is exactly what we're teaching. You know, kshayas, we just let them come up and welcome them. You talk about the kshayas so you're not afraid of them. And these thoughts all come up. So it's kind of weird to have this whole, volcano of the thoughts pushing up into your mind. It can happen sometimes. Just be able to understand that happens and to welcome it, and it's a good thing. It's your body just releasing a lot of, stored in the unconscious. So that's how we talk about that. In meditation, can you please explain, differentiate between taking yourself to be the Shantavritti, having an experience of the real you, Ananda, having an experience of the, between these things. One, taking yourself to be the Shantavritti, having an experience of the real you, Ananda, being with the self, Nididhyasana. Okay, I can do that. Taking yourself to be the Shantavritti. Taking yourself to be the Shantavritti is perhaps one of the most common problems. And when you have a Shantavritti, there's the sense of my own nature is present in that Shantavritti. What I recognize as me, there's the Shanti, there's the peace, there's fullness, there's Ananda. There's a sense of all is well with me, you know? And so with this teaching, which is pointing at the Satchitananda Atma, you know, when we have a Shantavritti, then we can feel, there, that's who I really am. And in a sense, it's not that far from being correct, because a real Shantavritti does mirror me quite closely, so that there's not a big difference between my own being and the Shantavritti. Except that the Shantavritti comes and goes, right? And then I feel that I've gone, and then I have to try to get myself back. And so the questions that were often asked of Swamiji is, Swamiji, I know myself, but I don't know how to keep myself here. I know myself, but it always goes, What will it take for me just to be able to be with myself? Okay, so when you're saying that, that means that you're identifying yourself with the Shantavritti. Because in fact, yourself is present in every vritti. And it's also not covered by any vritti. Except if there's self-ignorance there, then even that's not a real covering. It's not like there's a bag over the self or something that a real covering, or some dark cloth covering the self. It's not that at all. It's that there's no viveka, because of the self-ignorance, there's no viveka between your own self-experience, that non-objectifiable, self-evident me, and the mind. And then there's no viveka between the mind and the body, because my mind is just the brain, it's as long as I have this body, I have my mind, And my mind is the conscious being, because I know that this body can be dead. I've experienced death. So then I take myself to be the mind, and the mind to be maybe a product of the body. I don't know any of this, but this is just what I kind of assume without too much thought. Right? And so what has to take place is that viveka, between the discrimination between the self-evident me, conscious being, and the changing thought modifications, because I actually have to recognize the changelessness, the permanence, the non-fluctuating nature, and bhava, being, the ananda, the wholeness, or that beloved nature of my being, no matter what vritti is there. So I was saying earlier that, really for a jnani, unless the mind is causing you pain, if it's a little irritable or this way or that way. It doesn't really make any difference because nothing's happening to you. And that's what we call aparoksha. It's absolutely self-evident. And so your mind really isn't disturbing that unless you have some sort of a hangover in the form of a binding desire where your ananda is still being projected out. In which case, that nishta isn't really there. So anyway, what this amounts to is that one of the problems as I'm starting to really see and gain knowledge is that I start identifying myself with the shantavritti, right? And so then the shantavritti, I see myself, I recognize myself, but then I go, you know. And so then there's something that we really have to work on because it's such a common problem, is that the shantavritti also is objectified. It also comes and goes. So you have to almost say, you know, what is there is the same between the dukkha vritti and the shanta vritti. Because the dukkha vritti, the sorrowful vritti, sorrowful thought modification, and the sukha, the ananda, the happy thought modification, those kind of negate each other itself. I wouldn't call a dukkha vritti a sukha vritti, in other words. I'm not going to get confused about that. But what if I ask you, what is there that is the same between the two? And that is me. The one who has the sukha-vritti is the one that has the dukkha-vritti. But can I differentiate me, my own being, from these thought modifications which are actually objectified? So for moksha, for liberation, that's what actually... Liberation is the recognition of the liberated self. It's not like you become liberated. Nobody's becoming liberated. If you can become liberated, you exist within time and space and you'll become unliberated also. In the sense that the liberated self is only temporary because it exists within time. So it's not a matter of gaining liberation. It's a matter of recognizing your own nature, which is ever free. And part of that recognition has to do with viveka, the ability to discriminate my own being from all of my experiences and recognize the constancy of myself, the wholeness of myself, the satchitananda of myself, and then on and on to Ishwara and all of that. But once I recognize that, then the shantavrittis are nice and natural to the mind that has, you know, resolved these binding desires, these ragadveshas. The shantavrittis are very natural to the mind, but they're not me. They're the mind, right? They're Maya. That's why, this is just a little aside that for some of you to think be valuable. The shantavrittis, which give different varieties of ananda, the experience of ananda, in different forms that we have words for, like compassion or love or sympathy or joy or happiness. We have many, many different words for those different types, for different qualities of shantavrittis. Bliss is another one. Just a minute, I lost my train of thought. What was I saying? Yeah, I know, but that wasn't it. All right, we'll just sit here until it comes back. It sounds good because I'll just meditate for a little while. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay. Let me see him. I don't know what I was saying, but I think I was going in this direction. The shantavrittis are just a natural expression of myself. But because they're a natural expression of myself and I feel good about them, that's nice, I don't necessarily even know or think to differentiate them from me. Yeah. But the thing is that every single vritti on the whole continuum from dukkha, all the dukkha vrittis to all the sukha vrittis, really need to be differentiated from me because I'm actually not changing in any way in the presence of any vritti. In fact, it's not even at all that the vrittis are covering me. Like the story I told, I don't know, a week or two ago, that's often misunderstood about the sun illumining the thunderstorm and the dark clouds of the sky. You know, the sun is illumining these really dark clouds. And somebody standing, you know, on the beach, for instance, is looking up and saying, oh, wow, you know, I know the sun is there, but I can't experience it. That's what they're saying. I know the sun is there, but I can't experience it because the dark clouds are in the way. This is how we feel about our vrittis. I know I'm there because I've had glimpses of myself. When I have a shanta vritti, I know I'm there. But now the dark clouds, you know, are covering me. But I also know that I wouldn't even be able to see the dark clouds if I wasn't there. I have this type of thinking. That means I'm still kind of on the ahankara is still on the other side of the storm, right? And so it's only experiencing itself as the mind, and the mind, you know, has been totally superimposed onto the self. So I am this dark cloud right now. I am this dark cloudy mind. When there's viveka. I'm not the dark cloudy mind. I'm the sun that illumines the dark cloudy mind. But that's the viveka. If that viveka isn't there, then I become like the person on the shore looking up at the sun, realizing that it's so dark and out, I can't experience myself at all. I can just experience that which I illumine. See what I mean? So that viveka is a tricky, it can be a tricky thing. Because I can have these shantavrittis where I really feel like myself, and then I have a viveka between myself, this shantavritti, and the dark cloud shantavritti. But that's not the viveka that we're looking for. That's the viveka that every samsari has. I can distinguish this experience from this experience from this experience very clearly. We can all do that. That's not viveka. Viveka is the discrimination of my own being from everything else, that anything else that it can be objectified within time. So the viveka is kind of this way, not this way, you know. And so that means I can use, very effectively, use the shantavrittis and the dukkavrittis and the neutral vrittis to recognize the constancy of my own presence in the midst of every experience that I have. And that's the moksha, to recognize that I am free no matter what experience comes and goes, because the experiences that come and go, they're mitya, they exist within time and space, they're a different order of reality, they come and go, and I remain exactly the same, just like the sun remains exactly the same, no matter what the experience is that is being illumined. The sun doesn't identify itself. It doesn't even know those experiences are there. From the standpoint of the sun, its brilliance, because its brightness is illumining everything. The sun's not thinking, oh, let me illumine everything now. It just is that. It is that. And myself is that. It just is a conscious being because of which everything is known. It's the knownness, the self-evident knownness because of which everything is known. But I have differentiated that from these experiences that come and go. So the liberation is the liberation of a free self, right? Liberation is the liberation of a liberated self. It's recognizing I've always been free, I always will be free. And so then I mentioned a little earlier that the jnani's mind can just be satisfied with, doesn't have to be perfect, just doesn't matter if it has some dukkavritti, it has some agitation, what difference does it make? It's just mithya, it just comes and goes, you know. Because you're not coming and going in the presence of those vrittis. So it's not affecting you really. It's not like you all of a sudden become agitated when your mind is agitated. That agitation is taking place in the absolute shanti of myself. That's why we do some of these actually taking any experience I have and any experience and differentiating it, letting the buddhi objectify it and come into relationship with it. Every time I do that, even from the standpoint of the buddhi, becomes a shantavritti, right? Because it's objectified the ashanti, that which isn't shanti. Okay? So when it does that, it itself is shanti, and it can come into an objective relationship with the sorrow or the agitation. But that buddhi is, in a sense, just a voice for me, the way that actually it always is. Every thought, every experience is always coming into me. That is always shanti. So if that viveka is there, then I don't feel maybe the necessity, or some people don't feel the necessity to work on little agitations and whatnot, because you can just kind of blow them away. So there's no real reason to work on them if you doesn't make any difference anyway. But those binding desires, as those are there, those kind of do make a difference. You know, those are like leftover little bits of ajnanam acting out, little ajnana bits acting out, you know, and causing pain for no reason. So those we usually will try to work on. Yeah. Taking yourself to be the shantavritti, having an experience of the real you, ananda. The experience of the real you is recognizing the one who is never not there and is not covered. You know, so actually, all of the experiences that take place in your mind, that's a really beautiful exercise to do, to recognize the me that is really not covered, because our mind gets confused by the word bliss. So we're looking for a bliss experience, not recognizing what we mean by ananda in terms of your own self. Because otherwise I would have to be waiting for there to be an underlying bliss experience. But no, that you have to recognize your being that is here right now, and it's really the same one being for all beings. It's not a bliss experience, but there's nothing more dear. So that's what you have to start looking for. And that me is never challenged or covered in any way. But we think that it is, because we're thinking bliss experience, and bliss experience is negated by a dukkha-vritti. But I am not. I'm as much there present to a dukkha-vritti as I am to a sukha-vritti. So that's what I have to look at. And you're shocked when you recognize it. And it kind of goes, for me it went like this. Oh, they mean me. Yeah, exactly. They mean me. If I have a dukkha-vritti, this me is there completely uncovered, just me. There's nothing to cover it. And if a sukha-vritti is there, that me is there. But I'm much more to identify with the sukha-vritti or the shanta-vritti than I am with the dukkha-vritti. And that's a trap. It's a nice trap, but it's still, I mean, it's pleasurable and all that, but still, that's not it. That's the thing. Then, being with the self, it starts like when we do some of these guided meditations, where I say, let the buddhi, you know, just gently focus on yourself. Then I don't say being with yourself there. I say then be yourself. Because the buddhi is like the shantavritti, you know, focusing with knowledge, focusing on your own being. But that being is you. You know, and so you're not just experiencing yourself from the, because the buddhi is looking at you as though that's why you know you. That's why you know yourself, is because the buddhi is looking at you. You're actually the conscious being because of which the buddhi is illumined. But when the buddhi focuses on you, then it itself is filled with you. So you are illumining, your self-evident you is illumining an experience, the experience of the buddhi, which instead of being focused on something else, is focused on me. So this buddhi becomes as though a mirror, so kind of erases itself in a way. Becomes as though invisible, because its content is only me, and so I'm just left as myself. You know, and so then when we say this being yourself, it's those words are meant to kind of break through. The Buddha's looking at me. So I'd say, the Buddha's looking at me. Okay, well, why don't you be the one that the Buddha's looking at? Because that is who you are, the conscious being. So let the Buddha gently focus on you and just be yourself. So that's one thing, that be yourself is different than being with yourself. If in the guided meditation I'm saying, you know, just be with yourself. You know, that means let your body, your mind relax and just gently focus on you. Just be with your own being instead of running out here or there or there. Just rest in your own self. Be with yourself. Nididhyasana. Nididhyasana is when I'm directing my mind to recognize the aware myself. Because the first things we do, like the first part often, of at least recently, of the meditation, is not nididhyasana. It's inner child work, it's neutralizing raga dveshas, it's talking with Bhagawan, it's seeing what's bothering me, and tracing raga dveshas back to their root, all of this type of thing, you know, to really give the mind some shanti. You know, and to take care of it, to take care of the issues in the mind. So the first, it's nice to do that in meditation until you don't need to do it anymore. Because it really helps. It helps the mind resolve a lot of conflicts and worries and things that it has, or a lot of dveshas, you know, that kind of not being able to have certain people be around me, I lose because I become uncomfortable, or they generate negative thoughts in me that I don't want to have, dislikes and all of that. So then I try to avoid this person and that person. So that's not any good. We don't want that. So you can actually work on all of that to get rid of those type of raga dveshas. And you can do that really effectively in the first part of the meditation, get your mind nice and relaxed, and then do the nididhyasana, where I'm directing perhaps with a mantra, like Shantoham, I'm Shanti, or, you know, I am a Sangha, the Sangha Atma. Whatever words that you have, I am Ishwara, Ishwaroham. There's many, many words that we can use. Nityoham, I'm free of time, you know. Just words that are just simply used to bring my mind to me so that my mind has some structure. Can bring the mind to me just to be with me, like with one nityo hum or whatever I want to say, to bring my mind to my own being. And then the mind will wander off. And then you let it wander off, then you bring it back. And to bring it back, you could just say, come back now. you could say that. Or you could use a word that when you say that word, it immediately brings you to the forefront. Kind of like if I say the word rose, as soon as I say it, rose fills the mind, a rose fills the mind. So say if you say Brahman, I am Brahman, or I am the Satchitatma, whatever, as soon as you say it, if the word is known, boom, that's where I am. So I'm the word itself evokes, lands on me. So you want a word that lands on me, and then when the mind goes away, you bring it back. That's nididhyasana, bringing it back to yourself in the form of Brahman as Brahman, or bringing it back to Ishwara. Because I am Ishwara, I am Brahman. The nididhyasana is where I'm actually owning up my own nature. But then we have all these other preparatory things we do, like neutralizing raga dvesha, just being with myself, doing the inner child work, all of those things that are so helpful. And then we have things like pranayama that we'll do, or japa. And those things are also to bring a relative shanti to my mind so that it can do nididhyasana without having a lot of pressure inside. I want to think about this or worried about that. So I spend a good amount of time just settling your mind. And that settling is also transformative to the mind. So it's so worth it to spend that time doing that inner work, settling the mind, and then doing the nididhyasana, just directing my mind to myself. Oh. Oh, do all of us go through the same amount of lives before reaching moksha? I mean, I've never heard of such a thing. But you know what's interesting about that question is that since the creation, the cyclical creation, the creation is cyclical and beginningless. Maya is beginningless. So the manifestation of Maya, it was just cyclical in terms of the manifestation, sustenance, and resolution of the creation. It's beginningless. The jivas are also beginningless. They have no prior condition because there's no prior condition to ignorance. It's not like you had knowledge at one time and then you became ignorant. That's not acceptable at all. Ignorance can be removed, you know, but once it's removed, it's gone. And you can't go from knowledge to ignorance because you already have knowledge. And so you'd say the jivas are beginningless, but they come to an end with moksha. Just like ajnanam, ignorance is beginningless, but it comes to an end with knowledge. So what's causing your bondage is ignorance, because the self is free. So there's just because the body, mind, sense organs is limited in nature and part of the creation, not the whole, Ishwara, that means your experiences are limited experiences within the whole. And so even though you have a mind and you have pramanas, you have means of knowledge, the means to gain knowledge, the knowledge that they can give you is limited knowledge that exists within time and space. But there's no one to give you knowledge, to give the mind knowledge of yourself. And so it just takes itself to be you, because there's never a time when the mind is free of you. You know, as long as it's there, it's with you. So it takes itself. It takes itself to be you. So with ignorance being beginningless, say the jiva is beginningless, that means you've had an infinite number of lives already. So this is what Swamiji will say. It's like this. It's kind of a mind boggler. Infinite plus one is what? Infinite. Infinite plus 100 is what? Infinite. Infinite minus 100 is what? Infinite. So how are we going to answer that question? Yeah. Yeah. Maya. But if we could answer the question, we'd say no. Why would it have to be the same number of lives? Doesn't make any sense. It's just this little infinite part that confuses the issue. Yeah. I hope somebody's putting the bottom ones on the top. You have to put these bottom ones on the top when the new ones come. Because I'm never going to be finishing all of these. There's too many of them. I've heard Radha say that there's only one self-experience. Is that because it is not a subject-object experience, but self-evident? Yes. That is why. That's a good question. So listen, is there only one self-experience? Now, sometimes when I've talked about that, what makes you, the sense of me or the self-experience? The question is, does the self-experience belong to the self? Does this me experience, is that the nature of the self, right? Or is it something that belongs to the body? That's what sometimes people will think. The me experience belongs to the body, or that's because of the me, because of my body, that's why I have this me experience. And the self is just awareness or something else. But that's not true. What gives you this me, the me experience as a self-evident, most innermost, non-objectifiable me that is so known to me as me, that is the nature of the self. And so there is only one, quotes, me experience. The me experience that is me is the very me experience that is you. It's not that they're twins. We all each have our own little me experience. It isn't that. It isn't that the minds, because there are many minds. that each mind's relationship with the self gives each jiva its own me experience. There's no its own me experience. The me experience is self-evident. And it's the one that illumines all of the countless minds. But the minds don't contribute to the me experience. The me experience is your very nature. And so say the whole creation goes into unmanifest condition. What is left is me. This very me that is me right now, when the whole universe is gone, unmanifest, I, as Brahman, am left. And what does that experience? Me. That's why there's never any death experience, because I'm always here. The I, the me that is here right now, is the me that is always here. But it's just there's one of us, you know, with many, many different forms. It's one me, many, many different forms. So then, you know, all beings are you. The whole creation is you. Ishwara is you. So, yeah. So what's going on with this? So, is there only one self-experience? Yes. Is that because it's not a subject-object experience, but self-evident? Yes. Since there is only one self, the self-experience has to be only one and the same for all jivas. Yes. This is very good. Is it correct to say that the self-experience is not in the mind? Yes. Since it's only in the mind in the sense that the mind totally, like the pod enjoys the clay completely, right? The mind is not away from that self-experience, but the self-experience, if the mind is there or not, is totally irrelevant to the me, because the me belongs to the self, and it's not something that is given to it by the mind. So is it correct to say that the self-experience is not in the mind, since it is the isness of the whole jiva and the whole world? Well, the self is not in the mind. The mind is in the self, right? As well as the rest of the universe. You see what I mean? So everything, the entire creation, and from your standpoint as a jiva, the body, mind, sense organs, is in the self. As though that's a little bit misleading, because the pot's not in the clay. You know, is the pot in the clay? No. But yeah, but no. No, because there's no pot, really, right? The pot is mitya. And so it is nothing but the clay. And like that, the mind is mitya. There it is, we experience it, but in terms of being, there's nothing but me. Right? If I were to take me out of it, there would be nothing left. Just like if you take the clay out of the pot, there's nothing left. That's what we mean by mitya. The whole creation is like that. The whole thing has only me for its being. Right? But the me, the self, belongs to the self, not to the mitya, because, of course, the mitya has no being of its own at all. So the mitya creation has me for its clay, so to speak. Okay. So is it correct to say that the self-experience is not in the mind? Yeah, if you know what I'm saying there. Since it is the isness of the whole jiva and the whole world. Yeah, so it's not in the mind like a pea in the pod, like a pea in a pod or something. You know. But on the other hand, the mind, nor is anything away from it. Right, just like clay pot, nothing is away from it. I am the self of absolutely everything. Or when we call it an experience, it seems it must be in the mind. Please explain. Yeah, that is tricky. So let me try to explain that. We can't say that that the self is a non-experience, because what would that be? Then it's not there to even be experienced at all. But when we use the word experience, we're usually talking about an experience that is objectifiable. Like, I had this experience, then I had this experience, then I had this experience. So these experiences are the things that are coming and going, the experiences I've had. And so we can't call the self an objectifiable experience like that. It's not going to be in the same category. At the same time, the self experience, the self-evident me, is always there, and it's not a non-experience. I mean, it's not inert, it's not non-existent. I am me. I am very much self-evident. a self-evident experience. And when I mean self-evident, I mean that no, and what we mean by this word actually, swatta siddhi, it means self-evident. Self-evident means that no pramana, no means of knowledge is necessary to light it up. It doesn't require any pramana, any means of knowledge, where everything else requires a pramana. You have to have mind, or you have to have sense organs, in order, you have to have a vritti, in order for it to be known. If the vritti's not there, it's not known. Right? Then you have to bring the vritti back in the form of a memory. So all of your experiences of the world or that exist within in duality require a vritti and means of knowledge to give you the experience, you know, unless they belong to the mind itself, like what we call like certain like imagination, meditative experiences, memories, those type of things, but they all still present themselves to consciousness in order to be known. So for instance, say there's memories, unless you bring it in the form of a vritti to consciousness, it's just abiding there, it's there, but you're not knowing it, thinking about it, or remembering it until it's there. Right? So every experience, objectifiable experience that we have, requires a vritti. I don't require a vritti. All the vrittis, the whole creation can be gone and I'm still there. That's what we mean by swatta siddhi. I'm self-evident. I don't require anything in order for me to be. And to be means that I am my own non-dual experience, if we use experience that way. Otherwise, what would you think? The whole creation is gone, no vrittis, and I'm still there, but nobody, including me, knows it. Well, that's not saying anything. But if it is known as it being self-evident, then it's its own self-experience. It's not a non-experience. You understand what I'm saying? Maybe it's enough for people just to say it's self-evident, self-shining, like consciousness is self-shining. You know, it doesn't need another consciousness to come in and light it up. So we have to use all of these words that are pointing to something that is not an object in the creation. So the words have to continually point to yourself, and they can effectively do that in a very real way because you're there to be pointed to. Otherwise, it's an impossibility, because to try to point to something that's not an object in the creation, it's not really possible unless it's the adhishtana, the very self of everything in the creation, then that can work. But say it's just not an object in the creation, then you can say, well, that's because it doesn't exist. There's no way to point to it, nor to have it be self-evident. Something that's non-existent can't be self-evident. But you are self-evident because you exist, you're self-shining, you're the and then you have to say, well, what does that feel like? Well, it feels like you. It doesn't feel, it really doesn't feel like anything else. And so we have to differentiate everything else from me to say, okay, this is me, I can't get rid of it, I'm always here. And it's who I've always thought myself to be. It's just I thought that the body, mind, sense organs were somehow responsible for the self. For myself, my self-experience. Experience. Swamiji somehow, he also got tripped up using the word because we can get into this position of not wanting to use the word experience, and then it's as though people actually have thought that it's not something that I can know about. Myself, and it's not. You can't know about it as an object, but then I think, but I'm not something, I'm here, but there's not, but it's not something that I can know about or experience. So that means I'm here, but I'm a non-experience. That's actually what, because I've had this, and I've had these questions like this, and so has Swamiji. And I can understand the question. That's why we have to work so carefully to point to it. And it's not something, you're not invisible. Working as a therapist, you have been helping people to turn their dark dukkha vrittis into shanta vrittis. Wasn't it frustrating to know that the real way to liberate your clients was to help them discriminate, see their self, the changeless Atma, rather than working on their thoughts and unconscious, or is it necessary step before they gain viveka?
Well,
there are not very many mumukshus, and you can't create one. You know, a person becomes a mumukshu, somebody who desires of liberation. Somebody becomes a mumukshu when they do. So many variables come together, so much assimilation of their experience that takes place when it takes place, when they're ready, you know. And so when my clients, unless they are mumukshus, I don't have, and there's nothing in me that feels I have to make them one, a mumukshu. There's so much, though, there's so much understanding just within Vedanta and psychology that doesn't require you to be a mumukshu, and is still just extremely helpful, you know. Like a lot of the meditations we do, like with inner child work and all of this, and I did that with all of my clients, inner friend, all of my clients, all of my students at CIS, and I've gotten letters for years from students of saying how much difference that makes. So as long as, say, as you master that, or it becomes very intimate for you, then you will definitely pass it on when you have the opportunity to do so, because it makes such a huge difference. And then, you know, there's other things, like to students and clients. Sometimes I've told the water bucket story. I don't think I've told that here this time. The sun shining in three buckets of water. One is muddy, one is agitated, and one is clear. You know, I tell them just that, say, you know, there's somebody inside. You're inside having all of these changing experiences. You know, but the experience has changed and you're still there, you know. But I'll talk about it just very simply, kind of in psychological ways, to give them some space between these their emotions and themselves. Just some space. And that can really, really help. Knowing how to do inner child work, but have dialogue. Have dialogues with the different parts of yourself, emotional parts, that helps so, so much. But it never even occurs to me to try to make them, if that were to make them some mumukshu, if it occurs to me, what happens is I'm recognizing that that person is a mumukshu, you know, to see what happens with that. Yeah. But I also don't teach Vedanta to my clients. It's a different role. What is this? There's a little thing in here. Oh, vegan chocolate. That looks really good. Yeah, I'll just keep that for myself. If animals following their program do the right thing to be done, what is the best use of human free will and power to make choice? If animals follow their program, do the right thing to be done, what's the best use of human free will and power to make choice? Art, creation, doing dharma, loving. Well, the Shastra will say gaining knowledge. But that's the best use you can make of having the free will and free choice, you know, to choose to follow dharma, to choose to have antakarana shuddhi, to choose to seek, to be a seeker. That's the best use. Because that's, in fact, there's some verses that say a person who doesn't make use of their buddhi to gain moksha is a miser, is miserly. Where did we get that? You remember? Kripana. Huh? Yeah, Kripana, but where's the verse? I can't remember. Is it? Yeah. Good. I need to have my memory banks, bring my memory banks along with me. Yeah. Because you're a miser because you have so much. It's like you have so much wealth, but you're not really making use of it. You know, so much wealth, but you're only using just a little miserly amount of the viveka, the power you have with your buddhi. So you're not putting it to use, like, say, you're like a miser.
Okay. What is a miser?
Oh, it's like saying, what is a minnow? Yeah, a miser is somebody who, they say they have a lot of wealth, but they're very possessive of it, very kind of holding it tightly to themselves, and kind of afraid to share or to spend anything.
Snob.
Just tucking. Oh, you have a word?
Snob.
Oh, yeah. You got it? Yeah? Okay. Okay, these will wait now. Let's do, do we do a bhajan? Yeah, that'd be nice.
Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Brahma Nidhya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Varahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhad Bhavet Asato Ma Satgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotir Gamaya Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Shishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi